continued, "I shall return to London." He threw the cigarette stub onto the floor, took another out of the case and offered it to Barney. Barney flicked his stub across the room and took a second cigarette. Franz Jaeger was about to put the case back in his pocket. Instead, he emptied the contents on the table.
"Take them. I can get plenty more."
"Thanks." Barney put the cigarettes in the breast pocket of his outsized jacket. "He's dying, the Commandant," the other man said in a distant voice. "He is riddled with cancer. He won't bother you for very long." "Right," Barney said. Colonel Hofacker was unlikely to die before tomorrow night, but there was always a chance Eddie Fairfax would, and then he wouldn't have to keep the promise he had made. Eddie didn't die. It turned out he had pneumonia and should have been sitting upright rather than lying on his back. "So the fluid can drain," Captain King said vaguely. "The doctor gave him some medicine. I don't know the name. It's German." "He already looks a bit better," Barney remarked. Eddie was sitting up, propped against half a dozen pillows. He was fast asleep, but there was a hint of colour in his cheeks, and he was breathing normally. Days passed. The doctor visited every day, and Eddie continued to improve. A week later, he was talking, and his appetite was almost back, though he felt very weak and could only walk a few steps. Colonel Hofacker amazed everybody, except Barney, by sending up little treats for the patient. Breast of chicken, pork chops, marzipan cakes, the sort of food the prisoners never saw.
"We clearly misjudged the chap," Colonel Campbell remarked.
Another week, and there was nothing about Eddie Fairfax to suggest he'd ever been ill. Barney, unable to sleep, wasn't surprised to have a visit from Franz Jaeger. It was an unearthly hour, and the beehive was as quiet as a grave.
"The Commandant is waiting for you," he whispered.
Barney grabbed his greatcoat, shoved his feet into shoes, and followed the man downstairs. When they reached the hall where the prisoners ate, Barney pulled out a chair and said, "Let's sit down a minute." The big room was freezing. What little heating there was had been turned off, and his hands were like blocks of ice. The translator looked surprised, but took a seat at the other side of the table.
"I've no intention of going near the Commandant," Barney said. "I would be pleased if you would tell him that."
"But you promised, Lieutenant." The man frowned slightly.
"You gave your word."
"Most people would," Barney said bluntly. "My friend was dying, and it was an unreasonable thing to ask. Lieutenant Fairfax was entitled to a doctor, without the Colonel expecting anything in return."
"True," the translator conceded, "but I'm afraid the Colonel isn't a reasonable man. He thought you might renege on your promise and said to tell you that if you did, in the very near future one of your comrades would be shot trying to escape. It would be a simple matter to shoot a man who was outside on his own and claim he was trying to cut through a wire fence."
"He couldn't do that," Barney gasped.
A feeling of terror rose in his chest.
"I'm afraid he could. And he would."
There was sympathy in the man's tone.
"He doesn't give a damn what he does or what anyone thinks. As I told you before, he is dying, and his last wish on earth is to have you."
What was that line at the end of A Tale of Two Cities? Barney wondered, as a few minutes later he made his way to the Commandant's room. "It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done." Something like that. Eddie Fairfax would never know what his friend had done for him. Colonel Hofacker disappeared a few days before Christmas. Rumour had it that he'd gone into hospital. On New Year's Day, it was announced that he had died.
"You have no idea what he was really like," Barney wanted to shout, when he heard people say that the Colonel had been a decent sort of chap. Under him, there'd been an easygoing atmosphere in the beehive.
The rules he'd made were fair, and the guards hardly bothered the prisoners. And look what he'd done for Eddie Fairfax when he'd been ill.
The new commandant, Major von Waldau, kept a low profile.
Once a week he met Colonel Campbell, the senior officer, and they discussed matters pertaining to the prisoners and the conditions in which they were kept. The conditions worsened early in the new year, when 100 more prisoners arrived, and they had to live 4 to a room. Gradually it dawned on the captives that it would be a long time before they returned to their homes and families. It turned out that more than 4 years would pass until they were free. The years were boring and monotonous, but kept bearable by the strength of the human spirit to triumph over adversity. A drama society was formed, a library, clubs for this and clubs for that. Lectures were given, poetry read, sports days held, books written, shoes mended, socks darned, and a myriad other ways to pass the time were found. But Barney Patterson was never able to forget what he'd done to save Eddie Fairfax's life. It had unsettled him to the degree that his personality suffered a marked change, and the memory of that night would haunt him for the rest of his days. Chapter 15, May 1971, Pearl. I was angling for an invitation to Hilda's flat in Waterloo. She still hadn't signed the final contract, but she had a key. "I'd like to have another look at your bathroom," I told her when we collected our handbags and other paraphernalia from the staff room at the end of the day, the day after my mother had put in an unexpected appearance at the Carlisle Hotel in Southport. "My aunt's thinking of having our bathroom decorated, and I remembered how much I liked the colour of yours." I had no idea what colour her bathroom was. I just wanted an excuse not to go home, because my mother was there, even if I was only delaying it for a couple of hours. It wasn't all that long since I'd loathed Hilda. If she'd had her way, my mother would have hanged 20 years ago. Now I regarded her as a friend, though there was no suggestion her views on the death penalty had altered during the intervening weeks. She looked surprised. "You must be the only person, apart from me, who likes pale green and dark green together. Mam says when I move in, I should paint it different colours." "I thought the two greens went very well together," I lied, adding indignantly, "It's your flat, Hilda, not your mother's. It's up to you what colours you have in your bathroom." "I know, that's what I keep telling her." "To tell you the truth, Pearl," Hilda said confidentially, "I'm meeting Clifford outside the Odeon at 7:30. We're going to see Kelly's Heroes with Clint Eastwood. I thought I'd go into town straight from school and do a bit of shopping in order to avoid me mum. She goes on and on about moving into the flat with me." "Flippin' heck, Hilda," I was horrified, "there's only one bedroom." "That's what I said, but she pointed out there was such a thing as twin beds. I didn't exactly tell her to get stuffed, but as much as..." Hilda grinned. An unusual sight, but she'd been doing it quite a lot lately. "Tell you what, come Monday night after school, and you can see the bathroom then." "Thanks." I'd forgotten it was Friday. I supposed that I'd still want to get away from my mother on Monday, but I wanted a reason not to go home right now. I considered going into town myself, but it seemed a bit extreme. I'd felt really odd all day. Now it was time to go home, and I felt even odder. Hilda and I left the school and made our way to the back of the building, where the staff parked their cars. It was a cloudy day, but quite warm. A few children were still in the playground, waiting to be collected, and a group of mothers with prams had gathered outside the gate, where they were having an impromptu meeting. Hilda was in no hurry, and I was rather childishly taking my time, when a voice behind me said, "Hello there." I jumped and dropped my bag, so Hilda was the first to turn. "Oh, hello, Rob," I heard her say. I felt myself blushing, Lord knows why. Rob Finnegan was coming towards us, holding Gary's hand. "Hello," I mumbled. I don't know why I mumbled either. "I'll love you and leave you," Hilda waved and walked away. "I wondered how you were," he looked at me keenly. "Last night you were really upset." "I'm still upset," I sniffed loudly and quite unnecessarily. "I'm sorry about what happened. It must have been awful for you." "It was anything but awful," he shook his head. "It was one of the most interesting nights of my life." "Your mother's a bobby dazzler, as my dad used to say, and your granddad's right out of Hollywood. My family are a very ordinary crowd compared to yours. I've got a granddad in Ireland who wears felt slippers instead of shoes, striped braces, and smokes a revolting pipe."
"Granddad's nice," Gary chipped in. "His toenails are really, really long. He has to take his feet to a man who cuts them." He tugged his father's hand. "What's the man called, Dad?"
A chiropodist.
He's got a girlfriend, Gary continued.
The chiropodist or your grandad? I asked. The little boy giggled.
No, grandad, silly. She's got a glass eye and a wooden leg.
Grandad was only joking when he said that, son.
Your grandad sounds fun, Gary.
It wasn't really on for a pupil to call his teacher silly, but the more I got to know his father, the more familiar Gary was likely to become. Having learned he'd come second in the art competition, the little boy had been excited and giggly all day.
Rob said he was taking Gary to the barber's to get his hair cut in readiness for the photographer from the Crosby Herald, who was coming to school on Monday to take his picture.
I might have a trim at the same time, he added.
You don't need a trim.
He didn't exactly have a short back and sides, but almost.
During the last decade, loads of young men, inspired by the Beatles, the Rolling Stones and other pop groups, had grown their hair long. Although Rob liked their music, he hadn't copied their style. I couldn't imagine him letting his hair grow as far as his collar.
Don't I? He stroked the back of his head. It feels long. It comes from having been a policeman. I'm used to having it closely cropped.
I'm sorry. It's none of my business, is it?
I had no right to interfere.
If you think it looks okay, I won't have it cut.
What do you say?
He twisted his head so I could see the back. If I were you, I'd leave it as it is.
I felt the urge to put my hand on the nape of his neck and stroke it, which alarmed me.
Gary was looking at us as if we were a tennis match, his eyes moving from left to right and from right to left when either of us spoke. I had the sensation of this being a significant moment between his father and me. To offer my advice on the length of Rob's hair, and for him to take it, was moving our relationship onto a different, more personal level.
I won't bother having mine cut then, he said. Just Gary's.
Gary's eyes swung back to me as he waited for an answer.
Good.
The match was over.
I'll see you tomorrow at about 11. Rob said as I got in the car and he and Gary backed away.
We were going to Chester Zoo, he explained in response to my look of incomprehension.
I'd forgotten all about it.
That's understandable. It doesn't matter. I'll take Gary on my own.
There's no need for that, I said hurriedly. I'll come with you.
I'd sooner come with you than stay home. Gary tugged at his father's leg and Rob backed away some more.
Are you sure?
Really, really sure.
Charles had taken the day off work. When I got home, he was in the back garden with my mother. They were seated on white metal chairs at a white metal table. Both were drinking wine, and the conversation must have been hilarious because they were laughing fit to bust. I found myself smiling as I watched them through the kitchen window. Charles looked young and carefree in his baggy gardening trousers and an open-necked shirt. I couldn't remember seeing him so happy. My mother said something and slapped his knee, and they laughed again. She looked beautiful, in a dark green dress made from fine, silky material that was slightly sheer, so the shape of her legs was visible. I'd known she was lovely. I knew it from the photographs of her wedding, the ones in the newspaper during the trial, and from things Charlie and Kathy Burns had said. Yet there was that other photo, the one taken in prison when she was 40 and unrecognisable as the woman she'd once been. I'd been expecting someone old to come out of prison, a person who looked more than 49, not considerably less. She'd spent 3 weeks in a health farm in Suffolk, she'd told us last night, recuperating.
Recuperating from what? Marion had asked sourly.
From my time spent as a guest of Her Majesty the Queen, she'd replied with a throaty laugh. It did me the world of good, the health farm, that is.
I'd also not expected the woman who emerged from prison to be able to laugh quite so heartily. The health farm had been followed by a week in Paris with Grandad, buying clothes and other bits and pieces. I suppose she meant jewellery and handbags. I felt pretty sure that would help me recuperate from virtually anything, however unpleasant. In the garden, my mother got to her feet and began to head indoors. I raced upstairs and shut myself in the bathroom. I was dreading seeing her again. Since I'd known she was about to be released, I'd more or less prepared myself to meet her, but hadn't dreamt I'd burst out crying and fall into her arms. I sat on the lavatory with the lid down and relived the embarrassing experience for the umpteenth time that day.
I hadn't realised how much I'd missed her. I hadn't realised I'd missed her at all. I had imagined us meeting and me being slightly cold, in time becoming a little bit warmer, because she was, after all, my mother. I heard her shout, "Would you like some more wine, Charlie?" Charles must have said that he would, because she then shouted, "Red or white? Have you got any crisps?" I could have told her that we hadn't. Marion didn't approve of crisps. She said they were unhealthy, full of salt and a sheer waste of money. Some of the children brought crisp sandwiches to school for their lunch. I'd always fancied one. "What time does my little girl get home?" I winced. I'd never been called that before. I heard her go back outside. I left the bathroom and went into my bedroom. I peered through the net curtain and saw her put two glasses of red wine on the table. Charles took a sip of his, said something, and came indoors. I held my breath when I heard him come galloping upstairs, most unusually for him, as he went about things like climbing stairs in a calm and sober way. I expected him to go straight into the bathroom, unaware I was in the house. Instead, he walked into the bedroom. I couldn't tell if he was annoyed or amused when he saw me stationed by the window, almost certainly looking guilty. I felt guilty. "She won't bite, you know," he said. "I heard your car, so I knew you were home. Is it your intention to stay up here for the rest of the day?" "Of course not." "She loves you. She's always loved you. She was really touched when you hugged her last night. She was worried you might not want to see her." "I didn't want to see her." I felt tears come to my eyes. "I don't know what came over me. I must have missed her without knowing it, and now I feel dead stupid." "That's silly, Pearl." He came over and put his arm around my shoulder, and I laid my head on his. My forehead rubbed against his unshaven chin. He was really letting himself go today. "You behaved in a perfectly natural way." "That's good. Much better than holding yourself in all the time like Marion." "Where is Marion?"
"At work. Where else?"
"I thought she might have taken the day off like you." He snorted loudly. I think he was a bit drunk.
"Then you thought wrong. There's not much that would make Marion have time off work, and your mother coming home is at the very bottom of the list."
I moved away and sat on the bed. "Why are you and Marion getting on so badly? It's really upsetting." Instead of being sympathetic, Charles made one of the really ugly faces that had used to cheer me up when I was upset as a child. They'd always made me laugh, and I laughed now.
"You mustn't have noticed, but round about every 7 years, your aunt gets me down. It doesn't take long for me to get over it. You shouldn't let it upset you, Pearl, because the rest of the time, it's me who gets her down." He raised his eyebrows. "Don't tell me you haven't noticed that."
"She does nag a bit," I admitted.
"More than a bit."
"What's going on here?" My mother sort of floated into the room, reminding me of an actress coming on stage for the first time and expecting a round of applause from the audience. "Why am I being left out?"
"You're not being left out, Amy," Charles assured her. "Pearl has just arrived home. She was about to change into something more comfortable and come downstairs."
My mother sat on the other side of the bed and leaned against the headboard with her legs stretched out.
"It's getting a bit chilly outside," she chuckled. "This reminds me, Charlie, of when our Jackie Biddy and I were little and sleeping three to a bed. You'd come in the mornings when we were still asleep and jump all over us." "And who used to put cockroaches in my bed? One night I found six. I had to shake the sheets out of the window before I dared get in." He shuddered. "I can't stand insects. The lavvy in the yard was full of them." "That was our Biddy. Me, I wouldn't touch a cockroach to save me life. She used to collect them in a matchbox." "It's a good job she went to Canada."
Charles plonked himself at the foot of the bed where he half sat, half lay.
"She had a narrow escape, that girl."
After a while, I became like little Gary Finnegan, my gaze flickering from my mother to my uncle as they talked about life in Agate Street when they were young. In those days, they hadn't quite appreciated how hard their mother had worked after their dad died. They referred to her as Mam.
"I used to get annoyed that I had to look after you lot while she was at the pub," Charles said. "Later I felt dead ashamed of wanting to be with me mates."
"I used her lippy and face powder when she was out," my mother confessed. "I could cry when I think about it now.
She couldn't afford to buy more stuff. They said me instead of my, talked about lavies and butties. My mother spoke of walking along the docky. I assumed she meant Dock Road. The time flew by, and we were all surprised when Marion appeared in the doorway, struck dumb by the sight of the three of us on my bed. This was a conventional household, where people sat on chairs downstairs when they wanted to talk.
"Hello, darling."
Charles overdid the effusiveness to the extent it was obvious he didn't mean it.
"There's no tea made, but that's because Leo and Harry are coming later and bringing some pizza with them."
"I'm perfectly capable of making food for our guests, Charles." Marion looked as if she'd spent the last half hour in a freezer. "There's no need for anyone to bring their own. What's more, you know I can't stand pizza." I hadn't known that Grandad and Uncle Harry were coming. I slid off the bed and muttered that I would make some tea. I was glad we were having visitors. I hummed "Can't Buy Me Love" while I filled the kettle. "I like that tune," my mother said, coming in.
"Could you listen to music in prison?"
I'd broken the ice and asked a question. "We used to watch Top of the Pops. Some of the women would dance."
"Did you have a favourite group?"
"I liked the Bee Gees best. And that chap who sang about going to San Francisco with flowers in his hair."
"Scott McKenzie?"
"That's right."
Her pink lips twisted sadly. "I vowed I'd wear flowers in my hair one day, but I don't think they do it any longer.
Flower power came to an end when the Vietnam War started, but you can still wear them."
"Of course I can." Her face split into a dazzling smile.
"Does our Charlie still have roses in the garden?"
"Lovely red ones, yes.
Then I shall pinch one of his roses when they come out."
I was pleased that we were talking to each other quite easily. I had this silly idea of people going into prison and losing all contact with the outside world. I liked the Bee Gees too, and Scott McKenzie. It meant we could talk about music. She leaned against the sink and folded her arms.
"I was thinking earlier that it would probably be best if you called me Amy. Not now," she said hurriedly, "but one of these days, when you get used to the idea."
I made a noise that was impossible to describe. I'd far sooner continue with our previous conversation. I said,
"I've got loads of records and a record player upstairs. You can play them whenever you want."
"Thank you, though I doubt if I'll be here for much longer. It upsets Marion, poor thing. She likes to have our Charlie to herself."
"But Charlie, Charles, loves having you here."
It had been obvious earlier.
"I can stay with Kathy, and he can come round whenever he likes."
Marion wouldn't have Charles to herself if he was at Kathy Burns's house, but I didn't bother to point that out. Grandad and Uncle Harry arrived about an hour later with pizzas and wine. It was so unusual to be having so many visitors, as well as my first ever takeaway meal, that I felt childishly excited. Not long afterwards, Kathy Burns came, and we sat around the table in the dining room, eating and laughing rowdily. Marion rather pointedly made a cheese sandwich for herself and kept glancing at the communal wall as if she was worried that the people next door would hear us. My mother, Amy, said she'd telephoned her sisters in Canada that afternoon, and both had been thrilled to hear from her.
"Biddy's eldest daughter is starting university in September, and Jackie's girl is just finishing. She's going to be a biologist."
"If you'd rung after six, it would have been much cheaper."
Marion sounded more upset than annoyed at the idea of wasting money.
When she finished, she asked the operator how much the calls had cost and gave me the money, Charles said sarcastically. "We're not out of pocket, darling."
Anyone else would have looked uncomfortable, but Marion merely nodded approvingly.
"That's good."
We sat round the table talking for ages. Well, I didn't talk, just listened, while they remembered some of the strange and funny things that had happened during the war, though I knew desperately sad things had happened too. Kathy told us her mother had come home from the shelter one morning to find a strange man asleep underneath the living room table. He'd come in the back way thinking it was his own house. Mam chased him out with a yarbrush, though it was a perfectly understandable mistake in the blackout. The blackout had been responsible for all sorts of confusion. Grandad and Grandma Patterson had gone to the theatre one night, but lost each other when they came out.
"We had to get separate tram cars home," Leo said.
"I can't imagine you using a tram car, Grandad," I said.
He was much too posh.
The war was a great leveller, Pearl, he said. Petrol was rationed whether you were a pauper or a millionaire.
You could get things on the black market, Amy said. Our man bought a wireless, but she could never get it to switch on. She felt so guilty for buying it that she didn't mind when it turned out not to have any bits inside.
Uncle Harry said that as far as he was concerned, the war had been nothing but a bloody tragedy. Sorry about the language, ladies. From beginning to end, and he hadn't enjoyed a single minute. I lost my best friend in the world.
So did I. Kathy looked at him, and a flash of understanding passed between them. I wondered why.
Out here, Charles said, we were just spectators. We cycled to and from work every day, and nothing exciting happened. During the really bad air raids, we had Mam and my sisters come and stay. We'd watch the sky over Liverpool turn red, as if the entire city was on fire. We felt as if we were in a different world.
Elizabeth and I spent some of the worst nights in the factory in Skelmersdale, Grandad admitted.
Where did you stay during the raids, Amy? Cathy Burns asked. I remembered she'd joined the army and had spent most of the war years in Yorkshire.
In the cellar of the house by Newsham Park, my mother answered. We used to have fun down there. Does anyone remember Captain Kirby Green? He lived on the ground floor.
He was a damn nuisance, Grandad grumbled. Every time I went to the place, he'd nab me in the hallway.
I quite liked him, Marion said, speaking for the first time. I only met him the once at the fete by Pondwood Station. He seemed quite keen on your mother, Charles.
He was mad about her. She quite liked him, but not in that way. Charles smiled ruefully. I think the only man Mam ever wanted was our dad. There was some chap she worked with wanted to marry her, but she refused.
Anyway, Amy said, Captain Kirby Green elected himself entertainment's organiser for when we had an air raid. He used to spend nearly all his time in the cellar getting things ready for when the siren went. If it didn't, he'd be really disappointed. On Christmas Eve, the second of the war, the raids were really terrible. They'd been like that for days, heavy bombing every night, lasting for hours. I remember us singing Silent Night, and me wondering if Barney was singing it in the prisoner of war camp in Bavaria.
Chapter 16, 1941 to 1945. Amy.
All is calm, all is bright, Amy sang at the top of her voice. Round yon virgin mother and child.
Her voice was doing something to her ears, making them tingle. The louder she sang, the more she managed to drown out the sound of bombs exploding all over Liverpool, making the building shudder and the foundations groan. Any minute she expected the house to collapse on top of them. It had been the same every night this week. Even tonight, on Christmas Eve, there was no let-up.
"Holy infant, so tender and mild," she yelled.
It was a German carol, and she wondered if Barney might be singing it right now in the camp. In the cellar they were putting their hearts and souls into it, Amy, Clive and Veronica Stafford, Mr. and Mrs. Porter, and of course the captain, as they tried to blot out the reality of what was going on outside. She remembered when she, Charlie and her sisters were little. They'd used to sing While Shepherds Wash Their Socks at Night, and Mam and Dad would be really annoyed, particularly if they were in church. It wasn't often she thought about her father, and the memory of him brought a fond smile to her lips. This was the second Christmas since she and Barney had married, and they'd spent both of them apart. What was it like in the prisoner of war camp? The camp wasn't in a field with tents, as she'd always imagined a camp to be, but in a real castle that was very cold. Barney said he had to wear his greatcoat all the time. It wasn't his original greatcoat, the one he'd been issued with, because he'd lost nearly all his kit in France. This was someone else's coat, and he'd found a handkerchief in the pocket with an embroidered W in the corner. It must have belonged to a William, Barney had written, or a Walter, or a Wilfred. Captain Kirby Green was conducting the carol singing with a wooden ruler. He was making dead peculiar faces, twitching his nose and raising his eyebrows, as if he were conducting a genuine choir. Amy longed to laugh, but didn't like to hurt his feelings.
Sleep in heavenly peace, everybody chorused, sleep in heavenly peace.
The ensuing silence, though expected, took them by surprise,
and they blinked at each other. Until a bomb fell close by, shattering the silence and making them gasp. The house rocked, and Amy crossed herself. Captain Kirby Green merely looked supercilious. He had steeled himself not to react to the air raids, no matter how bad they were. He considered himself their leader, and that it was up to him to stay strong.
"Shall we pause for refreshments?" he suggested. "It's nearly midnight." "That's not a bad idea." Mrs. Porter had made a plate of sandwiches. As it was Christmas, they were having mince pies. "There wasn't a jar of mincemeat to be had anywhere in Liverpool," Mrs. Porter said apologetically. "It's just raisins mixed with blackberry jam, but," she added, a note of triumph entering her voice, "we've got egg sandwiches. Amy got the eggs from her brother-in-law's relatives, who live in the countryside."
"Good-o!"
Clive Stafford licked his lips. He was terribly greedy, and would eat far more than his share if he wasn't watched. Veronica made a face at him behind his back. The captain was looking at his watch.
"It's midnight," he announced. "Merry Christmas, everyone."
"Merry Christmas."
They all kissed each other. Clive Stafford kissed Amy with rather more enthusiasm than was necessary. Life was dead peculiar. Amy had nothing in common with the Porters, the Staffords, or Captain Kirby Green. She liked them, but their backgrounds were totally different from hers. Yet here she was, spending night after night with these five strange people, in a place where any minute they might die. It might be one of their faces, not Barney's or anyone who was really close to her, that she would see before she took her last breath. What a miserable thought to have within the first few minutes of Christmas Day. In Keighley, at exactly the same time, Cathy Burns was as happy as it was possible to be in wartime. Just like last year, a party was being held in the finance office. Sandwiches had been made, and someone had donated a Christmas cake they'd won in a raffle. There were a dozen bottles of Guinness and plenty of wine. For the women, it was miles better than going to the dance in the mess, and being pored over by troops who acted as if they hadn't seen or touched a woman for years. And for the men, it meant not having to fight for a dance partner. What's more, they all worked in close proximity and were comfortable with each other. Reggie Short, who owned the Radiogram, had bought some new records for the occasion. "When You Wish Upon a Star" from Pinocchio, Judy Garland singing "Over the Rainbow," and "East of the Sun and West of the Moon" by Frank Sinatra. Reggie asked Cathy to dance. He was an exceptionally handsome young man, with blonde curly hair and the features of a Greek god. When the war started, he'd been a newly qualified dentist, but had discarded dentistry straight away to join the forces. To his intense disappointment, he found himself still a dentist. The army had no intention of turning such a highly trained individual into a fighter when he was more valuable to them as he was. Reggie's surgery was next to the doctor's, which was next to the finance office. Cathy and Reggie had slept together when they'd first met, just over a year ago. Cathy, eager to throw off the restraints that had bound her back in Liverpool, was only too willing to go to bed with him when he'd asked. A few weeks later, she'd changed her mind. Reggie was clearly taking the relationship seriously, and Cathy realised she shouldn't just throw away her virtue at the drop of a hat. Even if it had already gone, she was determined that the next time she slept with a man, it would be for a better reason. For a while, she'd thought Harry Patterson might provide the better reason. She'd always liked him, and guessed he felt the same. She'd had even more reason to think that last Christmas, when he'd turned up unexpectedly. They'd got on extremely well, and he'd written to her afterwards. A lovely letter that made her suspect her feelings were reciprocated. But she'd not heard from him again. She'd been less disappointed than she'd imagined. Then, not long after Dunkirk, Jack Wilkinson had appeared on the scene. He was dead skinny and not even faintly good-looking, but there was a mischievous twinkle in his dark grey eyes that Cathy found immensely appealing. Within the space of just a few minutes, she was longing to be kissed by his thin, curved lips.
"Me old mate, Harry Patterson, said it would be all right to contact you," he said when they'd first met.
It was June. Cathy had finished work for the day and was sitting in the sun on the grass behind her office. Jack had a Cockney accent and a really wicked grin that made her heart turn over.
I've come in the lorry from Leeds for the dance in the mess. Trouble is, I can't dance. I've done something to me ankle, see? He limped a few feet to show how badly he'd been injured. They both knew he was putting it on. And Harry said, you're a good conversationalist. I'm badly in need of a good conversation with a pretty young woman right now. They talked all evening, covering life and death, religion and politics, the weather, marriage, and other topics that Cathy had trouble remembering later, until the sky had grown dark and the lorry was due to return to Leeds, by which time they were in love. He was the cleverest man she'd ever known, though he'd left school at 14, the same as she had. She had never dreamt that being in love was so intense, that your whole being was wrapped up in that one person every minute of every day. From then on, they saw each other whenever they could. Jack kept an eye out for any sort of transport going to Keighley and cadged a lift, twice coming on the back of a motorbike. Cathy found it less easy to get away, though managed to get to Leeds a few times, where they booked a room in a hotel, not even bothering to pretend they were married. They did the same thing in Keighley, and in neither place did the management appear to care. There was, after all, a war on, and morals, along with quite a few other things, had gone out of the window. 6 weeks later, Jack's ankle had healed, and he was sent to join Harry Patterson in Egypt. They wrote to each other frequently. Jack's letters were long and thoughtful, and Cathy's neatly typed and full of jokes, describing the funny incidents that had happened on the base. She thought about him now as she danced with Reggie, wishing a miracle would happen and he would turn into Jack. She wasn't like her friend Amy. She didn't think her relationship with Jack was made in heaven, or that she would die if she lost him, or that she missed him 100 times more than other women missed their men. All she knew was that she loved him with all her heart and wanted them to spend the rest of their lives together. The telephone on the desk in the other room rang, and someone answered. "It's for you, Cathy," the someone shouted. Amy was the only other person she could imagine telephoning late on Christmas Eve. Cathy abandoned Reggie, went into the other room, and picked up the phone. "Hello, darling," said the dearest voice in the whole wide world. "Jack," she screamed. Then more quietly, "Oh, Jack, where are you?" "Egypt. I'm in this British pub and there's a phone. The sort you put money in. It's taken all night to get through and I've got about 100 quid with me in small change."
100? She gasped.
She didn't notice the room empty and the door quietly close.
"Well, more like 5, he conceded. "How are you? I thought you'd be having a party in your office."
"I'm fine. Even finer now I'm talking to you." Her voice dropped to a throbbing whisper. "But, oh, Jack, I do wish you were here."
"So do I, darling."
She heard him put more money in at the other end in Egypt. It would be really hot there. She looked out of the window and saw frost on the ground. The sky was navy blue and the stars looked very close and unnaturally bright.
"I suppose it's cold there," he said.
"Really cold. It looks as if it might snow."
"I'll love you, Cath," he said.
More money clanked into the box.
"I love you. Why are we talking about the weather?"
She knew when she put the phone down, she'd think of loads of things she should have said. "I love you, and I miss you. And Cath, I really want you." There was a tiny pause.
"Right now, right this minute, I want you more than anything I've ever wanted in this world."
Before Cathy could answer, the phone went dead. She stared at the receiver, willing Jack to come back, and imagined him in Egypt doing the same thing. She said, "Jack, where are you?" just in case he was still there. But he wasn't. After a while, there was a knock on the door, and Reggie poked his head inside. "Have you finished?" Cathy nodded, but didn't speak.
"It's Christmas Day, and we've just cut the cake. Do you want a slice?"
"Yes, please, I'm just coming." She'd actually managed to speak to Jack, yet there must be loads and loads of women whose boyfriends and husbands were thousands of miles away in a strange part of the world and who had no chance of hearing from them. She felt dead lucky. Barney was writing a letter to Amy. He was sitting by the table in his room with his greatcoat on and the eiderdown wrapped around his shoulders.
It covered most of his body, but he still felt cold. There were no curtains on the small window, so it was impossible to hide the swirling snow that had been falling thickly for days. It was Christmas Eve, and the prisoners were being allowed to stay up until 1 o'clock. It wasn't long since the guards had stopped throwing snowballs at each other outside, despite the howling wind and the temperature that must be below zero. Now all he could hear were the prisoners singing carols in the mess downstairs, where he should have been himself, not shut in his room alone on such a night. He'd already told Amy how much he loved her and thanked her for the Christmas parcel that had arrived through the Red Cross. The chocolates, the biscuits, the novels, the writing pad and envelopes, and a set of pencils and a sharpener, instead of a bottle of ink, which might have spilled and ruined everything. The Christmas cards and little gifts from all the Currans, as well as the other people living in the house by Newsham Park. Amy had knitted him a scarf, and he was wearing it as he wrote. It had numerous dropped stitches and quite a few knots, but it only made him love her more, as he imagined her head bent over the needles, biting her lip as she usually did when trying to concentrate on something. "You'll never guess, darling," he continued, "but Eddie Fairfax is no longer my roommate. He thinks I don't know that he arranged for a Polish officer to move in with me so he could move out. Since then a couple of Frenchies have arrived, and we feel like sardines. Apparently Eddie was fed up with me. I was bad-tempered all the time and wouldn't listen to him. Both are true, but it was what I did for Eddie that makes me bad-tempered. I can't get it out of my head. I feel as if everyone is able to read my mind and know what I did and hate me for it. I wonder if Franz Jaeger had let it be known and it's being spread around." Barney raised his head from the letter. "People know. I can see it in their eyes," he said aloud, before lighting one of the cigarettes that Franz Jaeger gave him whenever he could. He was a decent bloke, and it was unfair not to trust him. He breathed in the smoke and could feel it warming his insides. There was laughter from down below, and he remembered they were having a concert. One of the best turns was two of the chaps imitating Greta Garbo and Marlene Dietrich, singing a medley of songs, most of them funny. But the finale, "Keep the Home Fires Burning," was quite touching. The laughter, the fact that he wasn't part of it, made him feel very alone. It wasn't something Barney was used to. He'd always been a very popular chap. But nowadays, he was on the outside, looking in. He returned to Amy's letter. "I quite like my new roommates," he wrote. "As I can't speak Polish or French, and they can't speak English, we have nothing to say to each other, which suits me right down to the ground." It was also fortunate that none smoked, so he didn't feel obliged to share the cigarettes. He finished by telling her how much he missed her, adding, "Some people here, more expert than me, are saying that 1942 will see the end of this damn war. Hopefully by the time next Christmas Eve comes round, we will be spending it together." Barney didn't bother to sign the letter. He tore the sheets out of the pad and ripped them in half. Then he did the same with the halves, ripping the bits until they got smaller and smaller, and the letter was a heap of confetti on the table. Then he opened the window and threw his letter to Amy to the icy wind, watching the pieces being blown away until he could see them no more. Then he started another letter that would be much shorter than the first. As if he could tell her all those things. As if he could ever tell anyone. The air raids continued, causing much loss of life and terrible damage, until the beginning of May, when there was a heavy week-long blitz that made everyone in Liverpool wonder if Hitler was trying to wipe their city off the face of the earth. Hour after hour, night after night, the bombs fell. In the morning, people would emerge from their houses to find craters where entire streets had once been, and friends they'd had for most of their lives, lost forever. Churches, schools, theatres and landmarks were destroyed, not to mention thousands of houses. Amy went with her mother and sisters to sleep in Charlie's house in Aintree, where the carnage could be seen and heard, but only an occasional bomb fell. Mr and Mrs Porter went to stay with their daughter in Southport, and the Staffords to Veronica's sister, who lived in Formby. Captain Kirby Green was invited to stay at any of these places until the terrible raids ceased. But he opted to remain in Newsham Park. "To look after the place," he bravely claimed. He was found one morning in the cellar, slumped in his chair. He had succumbed to a fatal heart attack during the night. But there was a smile on his face, and the wooden ruler was in his hand, as if he'd been conducting an invisible choir. Another Christmas Eve came, but there was no sign of the war reaching an end. The air raids had petered out, but things were still very black. The British had been driven out of Greece and were losing in North Africa, where once they had been winning. On Christmas Day, Hong Kong fell to the Japanese, followed a few weeks later by the loss of Singapore. At least Britain had gained another ally in the war after the Japanese had destroyed the American fleet in Pearl Harbor, and Germany declared war on the United States. Weeks later, the Yanks began to arrive on British shores, causing many a young woman's heart to twitter. Months before, Germany had invaded Russia, the biggest mistake Hitler was to make, as his army wasn't prepared for the savage winter, and it meant his attention had drifted away from Great Britain. A stalemate seemed to have been reached, with neither side progressing as the months passed. At home, 1942 saw rationing bite even harder, and there was a shortage of virtually everything. Amy was far more put out by having to use coupons for clothes than for food. She wasn't as particular about what she ate as she was about what she wore. It had become a ritual. It brought them luck, Harry claimed, convinced he wouldn't survive if Jack went around to shake hands with before they went into battle. They grasped each other's hands now, using both hands to make the gesture more heartfelt. It was 4 o'clock on a still warm morning in El Alamein, not far from Alexandria. The sky was dark, with an eerie purple glow, and the sand was like powder. If you didn't tread lightly, it would almost swallow your feet. No one spoke as the men advanced in uneven lines behind a row of tanks, sand spurting from under the treads like smoke, so that all they could see were the backs of the half-hidden tanks. The enemy was ahead and supposedly retreating, although every now and then a bullet would whiz past or a shell explode nearby. Jack marched slightly in front of Harry, loosely clutching his rifle, a grin on his face. He'd lost his socks, and his boots were too big on his scrawny feet. He was incapable of taking anything seriously. He genuinely thought the world was mad, and the people in charge were the maddest of all, yet good-naturedly went along with the craziness, never complaining. In the 2 years that Harry had known him, Jack had become more of a brother than Barney had ever been. That was no reflection on Barney, just that they hadn't shared the same dangers, taken the same risks. If there was one person in the world Harry would be happy to see marry Kathy Burns, then it was Jack Wilkinson. He had already agreed to be best man at their wedding, whenever that would happen. A red line had appeared on the horizon. The sun was about to rise. Harry hoped the fight would be over before it got too hot. If he stayed in Egypt for the rest of his life, he would never get used to the heat. He felt like part of a ghost army as they shuffled along, making hardly any sound on the sand. A shell landed behind one of the tanks, and another in front. Then there was another explosion that threw him to the ground with considerable force. He lay there for a minute, stunned, and when he raised his head, he saw at least half a dozen other men had also been floored. Dazed, he struggled to his feet, relieved to find he was unhurt, but considerably shaken. The other men had also managed to stand and were trying to get their breath back, apart from one, lying flat on his back, with a hole in his stomach as big as a football, while his lifeblood gushed out onto the sand, staining it scarlet. Jack! Harry knelt beside his friend and shook him, though there wasn't a chance on earth that he was alive. Jack! There was a shout. Get a move on, Patterson! But Sergeant Jack! Harry screamed. He could feel tears streaming down his cheeks. I know it is, Patterson. Get a fucking move on the lot of you. The medics will see to Wilkinson. They're not far behind. It should have been me, Harry thought furiously, as he looked into his friend's lifeless brown eyes for the very last time, before tipping his battered hat over his face. It should have been me. 18 months later, Harry Patterson was one of the first soldiers to storm onto Gold Beach in France as part of the D-Day landings. Harry would never be promoted, win a medal, or be mentioned in dispatches. He was just an average soldier who had fought diligently, never complained or answered back, and had always obeyed orders, no matter how stupid he considered them to be. Men like him were the backbone of the British Army, and without them, the war against Germany would never have been won. After D-Day, the population breathed a sigh of relief, as it looked as if the conflict might soon be over, though in fact it was to be another 11 months before the war in Europe came to an end. During that time, Amy moved out of the flat by Newsham Park into a bungalow in Walton, an ancient part of Liverpool with a pretty clock tower. The bungalow was on a little lane, no distance from the centre of the village, but Amy felt as though she were in the middle of the countryside. Leo Patterson arranged everything.
"Barney needs to come home to somewhere better than that poky little flat," he proclaimed.
Amy wasn't sure. They couldn't have been happier than they'd been in the poky little flat. But she let Leo overrule her for once. Perhaps this time he knew best. It was Leo who managed to furnish the new place. No easy task in wartime, when factories had more important things to do than make chairs and tables and beds. He laughed when she referred to the furnishings as second-hand.
"They're antiques," he informed her.
"They're still second-hand," Amy argued.
"This wee desk cost a fortune," he said.
It was rather a nice little desk, white and kidney-shaped, with elegantly curved legs at the front.
"I thought it was a dressing table," Amy said. "Why do we need a desk?"
"You can sit at it to write letters."
"I always write letters on me knee."
Leo grinned. She had no idea why some of the things she said amused him.
"Well, now you can do it at a desk.
Oh, by the way," he continued casually, "Elizabeth has invited you to dinner."
"Huh," Amy snorted. "You can tell Elizabeth to go and jump in the lake. I've met her once and that was enough."
"That was more than 5 years ago." He frowned as if she were being childishly stubborn.
"I think normal relations between the family should begin when Barney comes home, don't you?"
"It depends what Barney wants, not you, me or Elizabeth." She mustn't have a very forgiving nature because her natural instinct was never to see her mother-in-law again. She changed the subject.
"Isn't it the gear to be able to say, when Barney comes home, and know that it won't be long?"
It was almost Christmas, and this time people knew for sure it would be the last of the war. Amy hugged herself.
"I'm longing to see him, yet dreading it too."
She bit her lip.
"It's been so long.
You're bound to feel strange for a while."
"Am I? Are we?"
"Yes," Leo patted her shoulder.
He was very easy to talk to.
"Thank you," she said.
He looked at her, eyebrows raised.
"What for?"
"For coming round that day when I lost the baby. For getting us this house and all the things in between." He'd been an enormous help. Without him, she would have been desperately lonely.
"Don't mention it."
His face softened.
"Do you ever think about the baby?"
"A day never goes by when I don't." Amy's lips twisted.
"I wish I'd known whether it had been a boy or a girl, so I could have given it a name. Then he or she would seem more real."
"Just imagine if Barney had a little boy or girl to come home to."
"Just imagine," Leo echoed. "Wouldn't it have been great?"
Cathy Burns now had two stripes on her sleeves, having been promoted to corporal. Mrs. Burns told everyone she met about it.
"I always knew there was something special about our Cathy," she said to Mr. Burns more than once.
In March, with the Allies approaching Berlin, and only weeks before the war would end, Cathy met Reggie Short in a hotel in the centre of London. Cathy had spent 2 years in Ipswich, and the last year in Portsmouth, while Reggie had remained in Keighley for the entire period of the war. They met for dinner in the Bonington Hotel in Holborn every few months.
"What are you going to do when it's all over, Cath?"
Reggie inquired while they waited for the first course. She knew he would always regret informing the army he was a dentist. Had he claimed to have left school at 14 and worked in a shop, he would have had a far more interesting war.
"Go to college and train to be a teacher," Cathy replied promptly.
The course was open to ex-service men and women as long as they could pass the entry exam.
"What about you?"
"What do you think?"
Reggie made a face. Just carry on being a dentist. I think I'd like to set up a practice in a nice little village, get married and have half a dozen kids.
Good luck.
The same to you. Are you serious about being a teacher? Reggie looked at her appealingly.
Would it be possible to talk you into marrying a dentist who wants half a dozen kids? I'll reduce the kids to two if it would please you.
Kathy visualized the nice little village, the children, a comfortable life, but didn't feel vaguely tempted.
I'm deadly serious, Reg, though really touched that you want to marry me.
She loved him, but not nearly enough. You know why I can't.
Is it Jack?
Kathy nodded, and he continued earnestly.
You can't spend the rest of your life pining for him, Kath.
I'm not pining for him, Kathy said flatly. He's dead, and I accept it completely.